Chaitanya Prabhu Nishananda Sivaita Gadara Shuti Gaurabhakti Vrindiki Jaya Sri Sri Radha Krishna Gavagavya Shamahan Radha Kati Giri Gavardhan Ki Chaya Sri Vrindavan Dham Ki Chaya Nabhadab Dham Ki Chaya Ganga Jumana Tulsi Bhakti Devi Ki Chaya Nanda Gaudi Vaishnava Vrindiki Jaya Samaveta Bhakti Vrindiki Jaya Gopri Vrindhi All glories to some of the bodies, all glories to some of the bodies, all glories to some of the bodies, all glories to Sri Guru, Sri Guru, all glories to Srila Prabhupada. Okay. So last night we discussed different types of proof. And so we had all sorts of things which different philosophies advocate as proof. And we had these 10 different types of proof. But actually, when we come down to it, we can make it into three. That is sabda, production, anuman. Those are the three basic ones. The other ones all become combinations of that. And then we saw that sabda was better, and Pradaksha was subject to faults. So we had these four faults here: mistakes, inattention, limitations, and cheating, deceptions. And then Anuman, though it is useful, it depends on perception. And sometimes the perception may be wrong, so therefore the inferences may be wrong as a result of that. So, therefore, if we're going to investigate something which is beyond material perception, then it's useless. Both things, either pradaksha or anuman, that is inference or sense perception, will be useless concerning the Supreme Lord who is beyond the material senses. So this is what we call achintya, that which is beyond our logic and beyond our senses. It is inconceivable. So, how do we know about the Supreme Lord? How do we know about Atma then? So shabda is the way we get the knowledge. This is a little bit, for our Western philosophy, it's a little bit strange because they don't have that idea. It's either anuman or pratyaksha. That these are the two means of discovering things in philosophy as such. So in India, the philosophy is often connected with scripture. In other words, there's a religious connection with all the philosophy. There's very few philosophies that are not connected with religion in India. One of them is Charvaka Muni. Charvaka's philosophy is enjoy, that's it. Atma means body. Enjoy, that's all. There's no soul, no God, just enjoy the material world. That's it. So that was no sabda, nothing. The only thing is what you see. That's the only proof of anything. So we have those extreme philosophies, but not many of those. So even the ones that we reject, that is Samkhya, Nyaya, Vaisheshika, Karma Mimamsa, and Yoga. All these philosophies, they say, yeah, we accept the scriptures also, we accept the Vedas. Even in spite of coming to the wrong conclusion, they still accept the Vedas. So those philosophies that don't accept the Vedas are other religions like Islam or Buddhism or Jainism. But still, they accept a sabda of some sort. They don't accept Vedas, but they'll accept the word of Buddha or the words of Muhammad or whatever, like this, or the Jain scriptures. So they have scriptures also. So they have a sabda also that we don't consider perfect. But other Western philosophies, for instance, are basically non-religious philosophies, even like Aristotle and Socrates. No sabdas there. It's only anuman and pratyaksha. So it's kind of unique in India that we got a heavy reliance on shabda as the final authority. Now, as I pointed out the other day, we don't say shabda is it, and we reject pratyaksha or anuman, that is sense perception and logical process. We don't reject them, but they should follow after the conclusions of the scripture. So we can use logic and we can use sense perception to confirm what is in the scripture. To some degree. But some things are inconceivable, so they're beyond that. But we can use logic to understand scripture. We can use sense perception to see the scripture. Not much we can do. So, shabda is not just any sound like that. Or that's not shabda. Of course, it means sound also, but when we talk about shabda here, we mean sounds that have meaning to them. Now, of course, all words have meaning and some are lies also. People speak and they tell lies, so that's not real shabda also. So when we say shabda, it means words with meaning which are perfect, faultless. So that refers to the Vedic scriptures. So that is the source of knowledge, the ultimate source of knowledge, and everything else should support that. Independently, the pratyaksha and anuman will come to wrong conclusions. So we have to take the shabda or scripture as the perfect knowledge. So we have the scripture, but we also have all sorts of misinterpretations. So we have to have the not only scripture but the correct conclusion of the scriptures. Then we get correct knowledge. Okay. So what is scripture for the people of India? We have some accepted things which are called scripture. Other things we don't accept. So the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, for instance, gives this verse in which it says the four Vedas, the histories, itihasa, that is Mahabharata and things like that, Puranas, Upanishads, sutras, certain sutras like the Griha Sutras, etc., and even the Brahma Sutras, and Anuvakya, which means commentaries, which support the meaning of those works. So this is what we generally refer to as scripture. And other things people can claim to be scripture, but they may not. They may call it a Purana or whatever. We don't necessarily accept it. So in India also there's other works that we don't accept. There's lots of tantra. Shaiva tantra and things like this, we don't accept that. Or Shakta tantra, we don't accept those works. As it's not mentioned here, so we don't accept those works as scripture. So there is a limit to what we call scripture. So, the Vedas or the Shruti have a special authority because they are considered eternal. They're never created, never destroyed. They're always the same. And they have certain intonations, swaras, attached to them. And they're always pronounced in the same way. So they have a special authority. That is Shruti. Now the Shruti was one, or the Vedas was one. Veda was one until Vedavyas decided the people of Kali Yuga could not memorize everything. So he made four parts to it. And to each of these parts, he gave one of his students. And they started a disciplic succession of learning that particular Veda. So either Rig Veda, the Yajur Veda, Sam Veda, Atharva Veda. They also have different functions. Sam Veda, of course, is for singing. It's got Sapta Svaras, seven Svaras, and it's used for performance. The Yajur Veda is used for, mantras are used for sacrifices. And the Rig Veda is used for recitation. Atharva Veda is got many different types of things, more for household daily activities. They use the mantras for things like curses and whatever. So, those four Vedas. Now, the Vedas have different parts to them also. We get Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Upanishads, and Samhita. Now, generally, think of Vedas as the Samhita portion, that's the Purusha Shukta and those things. Huh? But there's other parts. Each Veda has a Samhita portion. It has Upanishads attached to it. It has Aranyakas and Brahmanas. Aranyakas means forest things, you know. So sages in the forest. So Brahmanas and Aranyakas are basically texts which deal with how to do sacrifices, rules of sacrifice, and how to use the mantras in sacrifice. So this is part of what we call Purva Mimamsa, or the Karma Kanda, the section dealing with sacrifices for going to Svargaloka, etc. The Upanishads are called Uttara Mimamsa, which means later conclusion. This is the Gyan Kanda. It deals with Jnana. And generally, everyone takes this as superior to the Karma Kanda. Karma Kanda is material. Going to Svargaloka, Gyan Kanda is for liberation from the material world. So it more or less rejects the Karma Kanda goals, and it says one has to get liberated from the material world. And Upasana Kanda is the Samhita portion, that is, it means worship. So in that section, we have all the different verses praising different deities like Vishnu, Purusha, Shukta, etc. So it's for worship. So each Veda, like the Rig Veda, will have Brahmanas, Aranyakas, Upanishads attached to it. A Yajurveda will also have. Each one will have different Upanishads. So, for instance, we've seen the Rig Veda has the Aitreya Upanishad and the Kaushitaki Upanishad. Those are famous ones. It has other Upanishads also. Yajurveda has two parts, the black part and the white part, Krishna Yajurveda and Sukla Yajurveda. So, in the black Yajurveda, we have the Taittiriya Upanishad, Katha Upanishad, very famous, Svetasvatara Upanishad, also very famous. In the white section, we got Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is a very famous, big one, and Ishopanishad. In the Sam Veda, we have the Chandogya Upanishad and Kena Upanishad. In the Atharva Veda, we got Mundukya, and Prashna Upanishad. And we have the Gopal Tapani Upanishad also, which is a Vaishnava Upanishad. Which is not, generally, the other ones are pretty famous. And generally, Shankaracharya will quote these other ones. He won't quote Gopal Tapani Upanishad, but our Acharyas will quote Gopal Tapani Upanishad because that's got Krishna in it. So, the student will belong to a certain Veda. His family is, they may be Rig Vedis or Sam Vedis or whatever. So, they learn that particular Veda first,
They memorize the whole Veda, and the Brahmanas, and the Aranyakas, and the Upanishads, everything in that Veda, all those sections, all the things that belong to that particular Veda, they memorize and learn. Now, if they're more intelligent, they'll go on to the other Vedas. That they'll be a Dvivedi or a Trivedi or a Chaturvedi, and they'll learn everything. But this is generally not possible in the modern world. But some people have done it. We see Chaturvedis. They learn all the Vedas by heart. They know it inside out, and they know all the other parts to it also, the Aranyakas, the Brahmanas for each one, Upanishads, and the Samhita, everything. So, at least you know your own Veda. So you know your Veda with a particular Upanishads attached to it. So that comes down in family lines, basically. Sakas, they're called sakas, or branches. In the modern world, generally, because it's not very profitable to learn Vedas. The sons go away and they go become bank managers or whatever. All these sakas are dying out. Yeah? So originally, Veda Vyas was there, and then he gave his disciples, as described in Bhagavatam, he gave each disciple a different Veda. Yes. And then they started like a parampara system, and the families would study those. And then it divided up into branches. Rig Veda may have like so many branches with families attached to it like that. But nowadays, they all died out. Most of them have died out. You got a few left. I think there's maybe Atharva Veda, maybe one Sakha left. 100 years ago, maybe there were, 10. Now, one branch left with people learning that Veda according to their ancestors. And Samveda, of course, also. There's a few, maybe there are 22, 100 years ago. Maybe there's five branches left now. So it's gradually dying out. I think there is some effort to record everything. So they go around tape recorders and record all the, recitation, how they do the recitation of each Veda, etc. Just to keep it, because everything is dying in the modern world. So it's only in the books. And not a living tradition anymore. But anyway, this is how that started out, and Kali Yuga gradually disappears. So we have the Vedas, like this. And we have Itihasa, which means histories or epics. The two famous ones are Ramayana by Valmiki and Mahabharata by Vyasadeva. And in the Mahabharata, we got the Bhagavad Gita. So this is scripture. We got the Puranas of Vyasadeva. He wrote the Puranas. He wrote 18 Puranas. Six called Tamasic Puranas for people in Tamagun, six in Rajagun, and six for Sattvic people. The Sattvic ones deal prominently with Vishnu. The Rajasic Puranas, they deal prominently with Brahma. Tamasic Puranas deal with Shiva and Agni, like that. So different subject matters for different types of people. Because the Upanishads are a little difficult to understand, and they're also very important, Vedavyas also wrote the Brahma Sutras to explain the meaning of the Upanishads, because it looks like there's contradictory statements in different places and whatever, and hard to understand. So he wrote the Brahma Sutras to elucidate the meaning of the Upanishads. So Brahma Sutras are very, very famous. So now we're talking about scriptures. So we have these different scriptures now. The Brahma Sutras itself says that you can't know the scriptures by reasoning or by sense perception. You have to go to scripture, Shastra Yonatva. Can they be known or not? Yes, they can. The Lord can be known, Brahman can be known, but by Shastra. Shastra is the source of knowledge, not scripture is the source of knowledge, not your senses, not your logical intelligence. That's actually the third sutra, Brahma Sutras. Okay. Now, sometimes we'll have contradictions in scriptures. what do we do? So we have rules. That which is Shruti is generally stronger than Smriti. So Shruti is the four Vedas, Upanishads, all those things. Smriti is all the other things, Puranas, Itihasas, this Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita is called Smriti. It's all called Smriti. So the Shruti has authority, great authority here. That's generally accepted. Now Shankaracharya uses this argument to therefore say what Upanishad says is absolute and what Bhagavad Gita says is not absolute. Because it's Smriti. So if there's a contradiction, then he says, oh, Bhagavad Gita, anyway, Smriti, we don't have to mind. We go back to Upanishads, talks about Brahman and no qualities and Brahman, etc. Yeah? So therefore, he takes Shruti, the Upanishads particularly. 10 Upanishads he takes as primary evidence. Everything else, accept or not accept. We can just make it agree with the Upanishads, that's all. That's his logic. So that's one thing. Another thing is where there is we generally in getting the meaning, there's a whole way we can start interpreting. We can take literal meaning, we can give interpreted meaning like this, we can start altering the syntax, we can interpret it according to our philosophy, we can take the root of the word and analyze it etymologically, so to speak, you know, like that. So there's all sorts of things. So we have a hierarchy here. A literal meaning is the strongest. Huh? Sometimes we can't take the literal meaning because it doesn't make sense in the context. For instance, the famous one is there's a village on the Ganga. So we take it literally, then there's a village floating on the Ganga, but that's not possible. So we just say on the bank of the Ganga. That's the lakshana, that's the interpretation. So common sense things, we accept lakshana for that. But sometimes we may use lakshana extremely when we don't have to. That is a fault. Therefore, a literal meaning is considered to be the strongest. Then we can use interpretation. We can start altering the grammatical structure to give a different meaning if it's if it's contradictory. We can go to other texts and say, well, this text says this, so therefore this one must be similar, even if it looks like it's different. We can use philosophy, a philosophical view to interpret. He's talking about this topic, so according to Sankhya, therefore we'll take the Sankhya view of it, or whatever like that. And the weakest one is etymological meaning. That means the meaning, for instance, Krishna. Who is Krishna? Well, Krishna is the son of Mother Yasoda. Okay, that's the common meaning we accept. Etymological meaning that we can take Krish as meaning attraction, Na as bliss, like that. So that's etymological meaning. Existence and bliss, for instance, we can say. So we can do that, but that's considered a weak form of meaning. Huh? So there's different rules like this. So now the words of the Veda was considered very strong, yeah? But then Kali Yuga, very difficult to understand, difficult to access because the texts are not all there. The sages who explain the text disagree on the meaning. So even the authorities can't agree on what the meaning of the text is. What to speak of the common people. So therefore the Vedas are not considered to be so powerful in Kali Yuga, even though they are Shruti. So, as I said, Veda Vyas wrote the Brahma Sutras to elucidate the Upanishads, but the Brahma Sutras are also difficult to understand. And different sages give different meanings. So we have Brahma Sutras and we have many, many commentators, each with different meaning. Because a sutra means something very, very concise. Atato Brahma Jigasa. That's the first sutra. Second sutra is Jamajasa Yataha. Like that. So they're not even sentences, they're just words, phrases. And then those words you can interpret in so many ways. So it's very difficult to get the meaning out of the Brahma Sutras in the modern age. Everybody has different opinions. So we have Shankaracharya with his commentary. We have Ramanuja has a different commentary, opposite meaning. We have Madhva with his meaning. we have later commentators also on Brahma Sutra. So a lot of disagreement about Brahma Sutras also. Puranas, an itihas. So Vedavyas wrote the Mahabharata, itihas, and the Puranas for the people of Kali Yuga to explain the Vedas. So they're actually considered to be another form of the Vedas. They should not be considered inferior in any way. Jiva Goswami also explains that a Purana is called a Purana not because it's old. Purana means old. It's not because it's old, but because it completes Purana. It makes complete the meaning of the Vedas. In Kali Yuga, no one can understand the meaning. Purana means that which explains the meaning so that we can understand it. It completes the meaning. And to complete the meaning of the Vedas, it cannot be inferior. If it's inferior, then how can it represent the Vedas at all? So Jiva Goswami says it's like we have a gold link on a chain like this. And then we have to complete the chain. So we make another link. What do we make it out of? Gold. If we make it out of copper, no. It has to be gold, same quality, to complete the chain. So, to complete scripture, the Puranas are there. They have to be the same quality as Vedas. So they're not inferior in any way. They're equal to Vedas. That's the logic. As well, this was quoted before from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. The Puranas are actually eternal. Even though we say the Vedas are eternal and the other things are temporary, ultimately the Puranas also are eternal in meaning. Now the words may change a little bit because history changes, etc. But we see that in the Upanishads, which are eternal, it mentions the Itihasas and Puranas also. So they're also, every day of Brahma, we get the appearance of the Mahabharata and the Puranas again through Veda Vyas, whatever. So they also, that meaning is eternal, and they appear every day in every universe like this. So therefore, the Vedas are called, the Puranas are called the fifth Veda. And Itihasas also. Itihasas and Puranas are called the fifth Veda. This is mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam. It's also mentioned in other Puranas. So we have four Vedas, and fifth Veda means it's equal. It should be considered Veda also. Should not be considered inferior to the Vedas. So it says Panchamam Veda. It is the fifth Veda. So in this way, Jiva Goswami equates the Puranas with the Veda. They're equal. They're in value. They're not inferior in any way. Now, what is a special quality of the Puranas is that anyone can study them. That is not so for the Vedas and the Upanishads. Well, you have to get Upanayanam. At least you have to be Vaishya Kshatriya or Brahmana. Sudras and outcasts cannot study the Vedas at all. So, the Puranas are better because in Kali Yuga no one is qualified anyway. So therefore, Sudras and less than Sudras can also study the Puranas and get the meaning of the Vedas this way. So that's one advantage. It is just like the name of Krishna. The Krishna name of Krishna is also available to everybody. We don't consider whether he's Brahman or Sudra or Mlecha or Yavana, etc. Anyone can chant the name of Krishna. Similarly, the Mahabharata and the Puranas are available to all people. So that's one unique quality of the Puranas and the Itihasa. So we have the four castes here, and for the Vedas, only the upper three parts, they can study the Vedas. And generally it's the Brahmanas who concentrate the most, the others optionally. They generally don't do anything, just chant the Gayatri Mantra, and that's about it. They don't study too much. And it is the Brahmanas who actually study the Vedas and Upanishads. Huh? And the Sudras are not allowed to even chant the name Om. They can't even say Om. It's considered sinful for them to chant even Om. Or one mantra they cannot chant. One mantra of the Vedas they cannot chant. One syllable they cannot chant. However, the Mahabharata, Bhagavad Gita, Puranas, Sudras can also chant, and of course everyone else can chant. So that's, it's more flexible in Kali Yuga particularly. So of all the different works written, the Puranas and Mahabharata are considered special. There are other works like the Smriti Shastras, etc. But the Puranas and Mahabharata are superior because Veda Vyas wrote them. He's a very special person. He is also avatar of the Supreme Lord. So he's very powerful. So he's because of his authorship, the Puranas and Mahabharata are said to be very special among all the different works other than the Vedas. This is a quote from the Padma Purana. What is understood by Vyasa is not understood by Brahma and others. He knows everything. He is, his understanding cannot be approached by anyone. So Veda Vyasa is the Lord. So his understanding, his knowledge is very, very special. So therefore the Puranas and Mahabharata are also very special. Now, there's a problem because in understanding the Puranas. Veda Vyasa wrote the Puranas for clearer understanding in Kali Yuga, but also he wrote three categories, that is Tamasic Puranas, Rajasic Puranas, and Sattvic Puranas. So therefore he glorifies Shiva and Agni and Pitra worship in Tamasic Puranas. He glorifies Brahma in the Rajasic Puranas and glorifies Vishnu in the Sattvic Puranas. So, in many Puranas, he's saying that the Devatas are Bhagavan. Why he did this? He's catering to all types of people. So the people in Tamagun, he gives them suitable worship. Shiva is in charge of the Tamagun people, so they should worship Lord Shiva. He's in charge of Tamagun, so let them worship Shiva. And by worshiping Shiva, gradually they can advance and get to Rajagun and then Sattvagun. So gradual process he is recommending in the Puranas. Now, this becomes a fault in Kali Yuga because people get attached to one devata and then they don't ever shift out of that attachment. So Vyasa's idea was they would gradually elevate themselves and worship Vishnu eventually and give up everything else. But no, Kali Yuga, they don't do that. They get attached to one mode and they're very lazy, so they stick to one worship and that's it. The Puranas also in Kali Yuga are not complete. Many of them have been parts have been lost. And so less intelligent people cannot really understand the meaning. So this is a problem with these Puranas here. So, as I said, the Tamasic ones, so they worship Lord Shiva, etc. And Rajasic ones, Brahma. And Sattvic ones, Vishnu. Like that. So, of course, they mention other deities also, but in the Sattvic Puranas, Vishnu is most prominent. In Rajasic ones, we have Brahma. There we go, you know, Brahma Purana, Ramanda Purana, Brahma Vavarta Purana, etc. And Tamasic, we get Agni and Shiva worship. Like that, Agni, Shiva, Agni. And there's mixed works. Sarasvati and other devatas and pitras are prominent. Mixed works. So, in other words, it becomes confusing for the people of Kali Yuga because there's all sorts of worship and they have to choose what to worship. Of these, we should understand that sattva is better than the other gunas. Krishna prefers sattva to the other gunas. Therefore, the sattvic puranas are more authoritative. If there is a contradiction between a statement in a sattvic purana and a tamasic purana, we have to accept the statement of the sattvic purana. So the knowledge is stronger in the sattvic puranas, that is, those that advocate Vishnu worship. Sometimes there's no contradiction. So we'll see that we can call from the Skanda Purana or the Shiva Purana, etc. And it will support what the Bhagavatam says. But other times, we don't. We reject it because it's contradictory. So, we see in the Bhagavatam, in the first canto, that after writing the Puranas, after writing the Brahma Sutras, after dividing the Vedas up, etc., Vedavyasa was unsatisfied. And then Narada Muni came. And Narada Muni gave him instructions on what to do. And he says this method of writing Puranas for people in different gunas is not proper. It's not going to work in Kali Yuga. It's too complicated. So you have to indicate one object of worship, Krishna, one method, Bhakti Yoga, that's all. And don't confuse by having them worship devatas and other processes, whatever. So, Vyasa is described also in the first canto that Vyasadeva went into samadhi, went into a trance state, and then he saw the Supreme Lord Krishna, and he saw Maya Devi, he saw Prakriti, and he saw the process of bhakti, etc. He saw everything that was represented in the Srimad Bhagavatam. So in samadhi, he got the actual meaning of the Bhagavatam. And this is considered to be the natural commentary on the Brahma Sutras. And it harmonizes all the scriptures. This is Brahma Sutra. It's an attempt to explain the real meaning of the Upanishads with no contradiction. So the Bhagavatam is considered to be the harmonization of all scriptures without any contradiction. It's a summary of everything. And it begins with a reference to the Gayatri Mantra in the last line, Satyam Param Dhimahi. That's important because the Gayatri Mantra represents the meaning of the whole Vedas. So this is a verse from the 12th canto of Bhagavatam. Srimad Bhagavatam is declared to be the essence of all Vedanta philosophy, which means Brahma Sutras and Upanishads. One who has felt satisfaction from its sweet rasa will never be attracted to any other literature. So in other words, we have the Om as the first syllable. This expands into Gayatri Mantra. Gayatri Mantra expands into the Vedas. In the Vedas, the important part is the Upanishads, the Gyankanda. Gyankanda is explained in the Brahma Sutras by Veda Vyas. And the explanation of the Brahma Sutras is Bhagavatam. So the same meaning is in all of these things, ultimately. So the Bhagavatam begins by quoting the Gayatri Mantra here, which is the essence of the Vedas. In this way, we see the non-difference between Bhagavatam and the Brahma Sutras and the Vedas and Upanishads. So in the very first verse, on the last line, we get this Satyam Param Dhimahi, which is an indication of the Gayatri Mantra. But of course, in the Gayatri, regular Gayatri Mantra, it looks like we're worshipping the sun. Here, what is the Satyam Param? This means the highest existence. Who is the highest existence? Krishna. So meditate on Krishna. This is the indication. Therefore, what does the Gayatri actually mean? It doesn't mean meditate on the sun. It also means meditate on Krishna. Sun is only his representative, that's all. So this is a quote from the Garuda Purana. This work is most complete. It expresses the meaning of the Brahma Sutras and Mahabharata. It is the explanation of Gayatri and reinforces the meaning of the Vedas. It is a sound made among the Puranas and has arisen directly from the Lord. It has 12 volumes and 100 divisions. It has 18,000 verses. So this very nicely summarizes what the Bhagavatam is. That is the meaning of the Brahma Sutras. It's also best of the Puranas, like the Samveda is the best of the Vedas. So Bhagavatam is the best of the Puranas. And it is the meaning of the Mahabharata, or Itihas. So what is Mahabharata? Mahabharata, again, is the meaning of the Vedas. And here's a little description here. It says that it's from the Mahabharata itself. So the sages weighed the Mahabharata against the Vedas. They put it on scales. And Mahabharata was heavier than the Vedas. So therefore, Mahabharata means that which is very heavy. Like bara means weight. Mahabhara means heavy weight. So Mahabharata actually means that which is very heavy, which means more important than the Vedas. Yeah? So meaning of the Vedas is there, but it's more heavier. It's more important. Huh? Huh? And the meaning of the Mahabharata is in the Bhagavatam. So Vedas is represented in Mahabharata. Mahabharata is also represented in the Bhagavatam. So it's the best of the Puranas, represents the Mahabharata, represents the Vedanta Sutra, etc. So Vyasadeva wrote the work. Then he taught it to his son, Sukadeva. Sukadeva taught it to the sages when Parikshit was passing out of his body. In the audience, there was Narada Muni and Vyasa, and they were listening. So when it came out of Sukadeva's mouth, it became more attractive. And even Vyasadeva and Narada were listening to this work when it came out of Sukadeva's mouth. So therefore the Bhagavatam that we presently have is considered very, very attractive. More attractive than it was before. So that's represented, of course, in the verse that talks about the third verse. Sukamukhad, from the mouth of Sukadeva, Amrita Dravya Samyutam, it becomes sweet, very, very sweet. So the fruit of the there's the Kalpa Vriksha, the Kalpa Taru of the Vedas, with all the different things in the Vedas on it. You know? And when you study the Vedas, then you can get different results from Karma Kanda and Gyan Kanda. So you can get the Svarga Loka or Brahma Loka or liberation in Brahman or whatever out of the tree. But it's described that the topmost fruit of the tree is the Bhagavatam. And then the Bhagavatam is touched by this fruit here. This is the Bhagavatam. And then the parrot, Sukha, nibbles on it. Mm. On that fruit. And it becomes even sweeter. It's already sweet. It becomes even sweeter when the parrot touches the fruit. And he puts his beak in there and it becomes even sweeter. So that is the Bhagavatam, as we know it. It is the best fruit, and then Sukadeva touches it with his mouth and it becomes even sweeter. Furthermore, Bhagavatam is also Krishna, non-different from Krishna himself. It is another form of Krishna. So therefore, it is a very, very wonderful work. So therefore, Bhagavatam is Shruti. Before we said that Shruti is stronger than Smriti, and so the Puranas are Smriti, therefore Shruti is better than Puranas. So now Jiva Goswami concludes that Bhagavatam is actually Shruti, and he quotes here from the first canto. How did the conversation of Parikshit with Sukadeva arise, through which this Vaishnava Shruti appeared? Satvati Shruti, it says here. This is Shruti. So, therefore, Bhagavatam is not Smriti. It's not an inferior work. It's equal and actually superior. Why? Because it's not different from Krishna, and Krishna is Swayam Bhagavan. So therefore, Bhagavatam does not depend on the Vedas. It is superior to the Vedas. It is the best Shruti of all. That's the conclusion of the first part of the Tapasandharma. Then he goes on to prove other things. So the conclusion, therefore, is that Shruti is, or that Sabda is the way of knowing about the Supreme Lord. And among all the various Sabdas, finally, Bhagavatam is the Supreme Sabda. Okay, any questions?
In the slide, there was some Yajurveda, black and white.
Yeah.
In Yajurveda, that is there. It's not there, so.
No, that only that Veda has two different traditions, two different sages made branches like this, and then they continue down like this, with white and black. They call it white and black versions, and then of course many branches within them also. So the other ones, no, they don't have two branches. They have branches, of course, but not the white and black, two major, not major divisions like that.
I was just wondering, talking specifically about Yajurveda, let's say if someone belongs to Yajurveda, I was just wondering, what does it mean?
That means that his family traditionally would study that Veda.
Okay.
That way they belong to that Veda. They would study that Veda, and they would do their samskaras according to that Veda. In other words, you do the marriage ceremony, but according to each Veda, slightly different. The mantras would come from that particular Veda. Huh? So they're slightly different. So then that's how they would determine. So their samskaras would be slightly different. The Gayatri mantra, the chant with the Sandhya Vandana would be slightly different. The Rig Vedis do it different. Yajur Vedis do it from Sam Vedis, do it different from Atharva Vedis. Slightly different. Huh? Because they're using the mantras from that particular Veda, which is slightly different. Huh? So that's what it means to be born in that family. You use that. And then you would study that particular Veda if you were able to first, before you study anything else. You become an authority on that Veda before learning the other Vedas.
This is again connected to what you explained, Maharaj. This Sandhya Vandanam, is that something which is considered auspicious?
Well, it's become a ritual more or less for the three upper castes and particularly the Brahmanas to perform. It's based on the Gayatri Mantra. And then, of course, all sorts of things you do along with it to prepare yourself and purify yourself and avahana, etc., to call Gayatri, etc. Ultimately, the meaning is it is Vishnu.
Yes,
according to the Agni Purana. And Jiva Goswami has written a little commentary on that to show how the Gayatri Mantra indicates Vishnu. Huh? So ultimately, yes, it is also a prayer to Vishnu or whatever, meditate on Vishnu. So nothing wrong with it. It's also a prayer. Unfortunately, different groups interpret it differently. Some say Shiva, some say it's the sun god. It's like this, or different things. So they interpret it differently, and therefore they don't get the correct effect.
Any particular reason that we had four Vedas?
This is how Vyasadeva divided it up. It was one in the beginning, he divided it into four. But it's functional also. They have different functions. So the Yajur for sacrifices, the mantras used for sacrifices, Samveda for singing, Rig Veda for recitation.
Ritvik.
Oh, well, that just means a priest. Ritvik literally means a priest employed for doing the sacrifices or whatever. So the acharya appoints the ritviks or the priest to do the sacrifice, like that, because they know the mantras, etc.
They will be from one of these.
They will belong to one of these Vedas.
I'm not very sure about how is it in the north, but what I've seen in the south is that many people actually belong to Yajurveda, if I'm not wrong.
It's quite common. Samveda is not so common. Atharva Veda not so common. Rig Veda, okay. I think a lot of Madhvas are Rig Vedis. A lot of Sri Sampradaya Yajur Vedis. Shankara's followers, I don't know, probably Yajurveda predominates also there. Samvedis is much less, but there's some Sri Sampradaya, Ramanuja followers are Samvedis also, but it's not so common. Atharvaveda is more rare. I think the only Sakas left are in Gujarat or something. Somewhere up there they have a few Atharvavedis left.
I think we discussed, if I'm not wrong, that in Yajurveda it is basically related to doing sacrifices.
Yeah.
Is there any sacrifice which is auspicious, or I mean, I'm not able to understand sacrifice as in would it be like a charity? No, it's not a charity, isn't it?
Well, they have different purposes. Like the Jyotistoma sacrifice, the Chandramasya sacrifices, etc. For different purposes. Some are big ones, some are small ones, some are daily sacrifices, etc. So you have all sorts of sacrifices, the Soma rites, etc. And you have the Kamya rites for going to Svargoloka or getting sons or whatever. All sorts of sacrifices for different things, different purposes. Some are optional, some are compulsory. Optional ones are for particular desires to fulfill. When you want to get sons, you do the sacrifice or whatever. Go to Svargoloka, do the sacrifice like this. So a lot of it is fruit of also.
Is the interpretation same as austerity?
What's that?
Is the interpretation of sacrifice same as austerity?
Well, sacrifice literally means the rituals connected with the fire.
Right.
Offering to the fire.
Right.
Austerities could be anything. It could be fasting. It could be, so many other type of things you could do to do austerities, but generally fasting is one of them.
So Yajurveda is basically fire sacrifices.
Prominently, its function is the mantras are used for fire sacrifices. Yeah.
Was there any reason that Bhagavad Gita belonged to Smriti?
What comes in the Mahabharata?
Mahabharata is part of Itihas.
Yeah, Itihas is part of the Smriti, not the Shruti, technically speaking, not the Vedas. It's written by Veda Vyas.
Exactly.
Mm. Vyasa didn't write the Vedas, he just divided them up. But as I said, ultimately we can't really say one's eternal, the other's not eternal, because even the Puranas, it says there, they also mentioned in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is eternal, so therefore that's eternal, and it mentions the Puranas and Itihasas, they're also eternal. But they change slightly with the histories of each yuga, etc. And another difference is swara. Vedas have swara, pitch. Up and down, high pitch, low pitch, middle pitch, like this, and the Samveda has 7 notes. Huh? The Puranas and other things don't have that. It's not fixed.
About what sweet, how do we imagine about sweet?
Sweet. Why is
if we have quality, can we feel?
Oh, the sweetness.
Sweetness,
sweetness of Krishna. We can say that the Bhagavatam presents Krishna, and of all the different forms of God, Krishna gives the most intimate love. So that intimate love is what we call sweet. Like Mother Yasoda with Krishna, or the gopis with Krishna, that is very intimate as compared with Vishnu's relationship with Lakshmi or his Vishnu Dutas, etc. So the relationship is much closer.
The Is it said about high level devotees?
What's that?
So
we listen to Krishna. Listen about Krishna's pastimes in the Bhagavatam. Yeah. And so we hear about Damodar Leela or the Ras Leela or Krishna's 10th canto. Then we understand the wonderful nature of Krishna in relation to his devotees. That becomes attractive.
If I have quality, can I feel?
If you have quality?
Prabhuji is saying this sweetness of Bhagavatam can be understood by any level of devotee.
Even the beginning devotees can have some attraction for Krishna, because Krishna is all attractive. He attracts everybody. that's why Narada Muni said, tell everybody to worship Krishna, because people are fallen in Kali Yuga and they need something very attractive, so Krishna can attract even the most fallen people. He's most attractive.
What is
Gopal Tapani Upanishad? This is an Upanishad which our Vaishnavacharyas quote because it's got Krishna in it, or the other ones just generally mention Brahman and Vishnu, but this one mentions Krishna particularly. It's a commentary by, I think, Jiva Goswami or Prabodhananda Saraswati made a commentary. Vishnu Chakravarti made a commentary on it also. It's about Krishna basically in Vrindavan.
My question is related to what Prabhuji asked. So when Maharaj, you said that even the beginners can realize the sweetness, and assuming that particular person goes ahead and follows in this path of Krishna consciousness, does the intensity increases? Intensity as in the sweetness, I'm saying. Is there that you feel it more when you...
Oh yeah, the more a person progresses, the more he realizes it. We get some realization of sweetness at the beginning. As one advances, it becomes sweeter because the realization is higher. As we appreciate the pastimes, we appreciate Krishna more as we advance. So therefore the sweetness and the bliss becomes more.
And that's because of the knowledge we are gaining through the Bhagavatam?
Knowledge plus realization.
And then relate that to our...
Because advancing in bhakti means attraction to Krishna becomes more. One's innate attraction to Krishna becomes more. So as a result of that, one's attraction to Krishna becomes more, and then realization and appreciation becomes more. Even Shishupala was attracted to Krishna in spite of himself because of Krishna's attractive nature. Couldn't help but think of Krishna all day long even though he hated him. So he absorbed in him because of his attractive qualities.
Yeah.